Thanks for listening to the Roman Circus podcast. We're back once again, two in a row, Zach. This is a new streak. We're starting a new streak. Everybody should be excited. I'm Matt Baker, and with me, as always, is a man who's sitting somewhere on the other side of the country from me, Zach Mabry. Zach, how are you, my friend?
I am great, Matt. How are you?
I'm great. If you want to follow us on Twitter, we're at Roman Circus Pod. I'm at, hey, it's Matt Baker, and Zach is at Zach Mabry, Z-A-C Mabry. Email us, podcast@romancircusblog.com. You can find us wherever podcasts are. Are you on Blue Sky or Mastodon? Or are you on Threads? What's your...
So I'm on Threads. I'm on Mastodon, and I have a Blue Sky link activation code from friend of the pod, Father Dan, that I still haven't actually used, which I feel bad about because he asked if I was going to actually use it or if he could have it back. And I figured I'll use it. I got to do it now because I want to reserve the username, and there could be someone that hears this and goes and grabs it up.
Digital squatting. I'm surprised they haven't done it already.
So true. Those are funny to me because what I really think we've seen over the past year, and Threads was the final form of this, I think, because everybody already, you know, Threads is connected to Instagram and Facebook. Mm-hmm. And so everybody already had an account and who they're connected to. Right. So it's not because a lot of, you know, Twitter, it was all like, oh, well, I already follow people and people follow me. You can't just move that to something new like Blue Sky or Mastodon or whatever, or what are the other ones? There's Blue Sky, Mastodon,
Threads,
Parlor.
That's all it. Parlor, yeah.
And then what was
Truth
the other
Social?
One? Truth Social, and then the first one that came out,
Twitter.
The first, no, when you're the first, like, what was the first version when you're canceled off of Twitter and you would go on to it? Why am I forgetting what it's called? It was the
was it not Parlor?
No, it was before Parlor. But it was similar in that people were like, oh, this is just for racists or whatever. Mm-hmm. What was it? We need one of those people that looks things up, like on Rogan. We're like, look this up.
You should have saved, that would have been a great segue for later if we saved this where you're like, oh, it's just for racists. And I could have been like, speaking of racism, Zach. But alas.
How am I forgetting? It was like 2006.
2016?
Yes.
I don't know.
Like Milo was on it. Gab. That was it.
Gab.
What was that other one? Gab. So it's always funny to me that the first Twitter replacements were Gab, which was kind of like openly a racist thing once it got going, and then Parler, which was at least deemed that. And then, and you had like Kate Hopkins and stuff on it, like people that were right, like they were kicked off of other apps for being right wingers. Mm-hmm. But so then whenever the other ones pop up, I'm like, oh, you know, too racist for Twitter. But I understand that's not the case with either Mastodon or Blue Sky. But no, so with Threads, you have everybody's already on there and they're already connected to their friends. And when you join, it gives you the option to just automatically follow everyone that you're following on Instagram and stuff. Mm-hmm. And people use it for like a day and then it ran out of steam. And I mean, I check it, but there's nothing happening there.
Man, it ran out of steam so hard.
Yeah. In the meantime, Twitter has like changed its name to X. It's introduced this weird kind of rate limiting thing that's enforced sporadically. It's, you know, everything you could do to make the app worse seems to be happening. Mm-hmm. And then it's still just trucking along. So what I would say is that Zuckerberg proved that you can't replace Twitter. Mm-hmm. And then Musk has proved that you can't destroy Twitter. You can try, but
yeah, it's basically its own thing right now.
Yeah.
It's alive.
If it could be destroyed, I feel like it would have been by now, just with Musk's things that he's done. Because, I mean, it was annoying at first. People would, for like 30 minutes, they wouldn't be able to see their DMs or refresh their feed, and they would just be constantly melting down about it. And it was like...
Yeah, that was a wild day.
That was really annoying. But there are actually noticeably worse things about Twitter or X or whatever since that's all happened. So, I mean... whatever. But I don't care. I'll keep drinking that garbage.
Exactly. Well, that's how you know Twitter can't die. Everyone's just addicted to it.
Yep.
I don't know if there's much. I don't know if there's much in the news. News hasn't been happening the past few days, Zach. I don't know if you've noticed, but there's been a real.
There was a really important story broken by the New York Post.
Oh boy.
Did you see this, Matt?
Decent chance, but I honestly don't know what you're about to say.
So Barack Obama is revealed to have told his ex, "I make love to men daily, but in the imagination."
Okay.
That's the quote.
Getting right into it.
That was the quote. So the letter was about 40 years old. And he said, "In regard to homosexuality, I must say that I believe this is an attempt to remove oneself from the present, a refusal, perhaps, to perpetuate the endless farce of earthly life. You see, I make love to men daily, but in the imagination." So, who's not clapping cheeks in their mind, you know?
That's so self-important and pretentious that only a man like Barack Obama could have written it.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, if you read that and it's like, you don't have to like go to the ends of the universe to explain why you found one of your classmates attractive. Like, it could just be part of adolescence, you know, like it's not that big of a deal.
that's when you, start dressing him differently and you start prepping him for a different lifestyle, Zach. Isn't that what it is?
Is that what?
I don't know. Don't they say like now if kids show any like sign of anything, they just automatically assume they're gay or trans and just prep them for a different lifestyle?
I mean, to an extent, you think back to the 90s and nobody really cared. Boys could play with Barbies and girls could play with trucks. And for the most part, they didn't. And like people would try to, you know, I don't give my girls stereotypical toys. And then they give them like nunchucks and they look and they'd have like tucked them into bed and like drawn faces on them. But yeah, I mean, in the 90s, at least, I mean, probably to some extent now, like we can't make everything like a Newsmax story, but boys and girls could kind of just play with the toys they thought were fun. And then there's this sort of, they're kind of like stage moms, but they're looking for any sign that their child is, you know, trans and therefore special because there's nothing more special than having a kid that's special. And then they start going for it. And I mean, I've seen screenshots from the Facebook posts from these parents that have like 6-year-olds that they've decided are going to transition. And it's like, you can tell that it's like, it's the parents thing though. Like the parents are like really want, you know, I mean, it's the same. Everyone gets a trophy, which it's like the 8-year-old doesn't care, but the parent needs to know that their kid got a trophy because their offspring has to be special. And so it's, you know, it's that situation kind of
good thing our parents didn't have to worry about any of their kids being special. Am I right? Right, folks? It's just like my nephew liked Frozen and he liked being Elsa and Anna, because those are the main characters of the story, right? And he's 3 and he wants to be the main, but he just started school. And what did he want on his school backpack? A basketball. And not that funny multicolored basketball the WNBA uses, Zach. A good old fashioned NBA man ball.
Lady basketballs. Are the basketballs the same size between leagues?
No. The women's ball is smaller.
Interesting. Does that actually make it easier though? Because wouldn't it be easier to catch a larger?
Well, ladies' hands are smaller, Zach. True. Have you ever met or talked to a lady?
No, never.
Okay, well that's good. There's a story that the Duke women's basketball team this year played with a men's basketball for half of the game, and like didn't notice, and no one knew that it was a men's basketball, and they had to have like an investigation. Like they did a whole investigation into playing with a men's ball instead of a women's ball. And it turned out in 2017, the College of Charleston women's basketball team played most of their home games and practices with a men's ball until it was discovered like end of the season, which to me is like, well, amazing.
Yeah. I mean, and that should calm a lot of people's fears, understanding that that women are not very good judges of relative size, but you, you know, you learn something new every day. I didn't know there were different, different basketballs between the league, but yeah.
But they're pretty noticeable. I don't know how you could play in like half a season and not notice it, but that's another story for another time. What were you saying?
Well, the Frozen thing, right? Like Frozen was the hottest movie when it came out, and the songs are catchy. You know, everyone's out here, Let It Go.
Well, and it's just the fact that like it's the main characters are little like girls. So of course, if they're going to watch it, they're going to want to replicate the main character, right?
Yeah.
It says more about the, what movies are instead of what like your child is currently. And totally. Speaking of main characters in movies, Zach, the people have been waiting for it. This is the reason we brought the podcast back, other than so you could defend Lizzo from all her haters, is true. They need the Zach Mabry breakdown of Barbie. Is Barbie, I have one question for you, is Barbie the most Catholic movie ever? And my second question is, if not, why not?
That's a good question. The most Catholic movie ever.
First of all, everybody should stop and watch Ben Shapiro's 40-minute video on why he doesn't like Barbie. It's a good use of everyone's time to watch 40 minutes of someone saying why they don't like something.
That was actually a whole funny thing. So the first reactions from conservatives to Barbie were all negative. I think most of them were all written prior to even seeing it. They'd already kind of planned out there. It's going to be wokeness. It's going to be this, going to be that. And then, but like a day or two after it came out, the tone switched and everybody started liking it. And they started doing all these memes of Ken on the right. And it was just funny seeing like everyone jump out with, okay, we're going to play the hits. We're going to say it's woke. We're going to whatever. Mm-hmm. And then when people liked it, they were like, oh, no, reverse course. What do we do? So that was entertaining. I thought Barbie was good in terms of Catholic. Not sure. Well, I mean,
Sorry. We're not a Catholic podcast that's anymore. Right, that's I keep right. forgetting. So I keep forgetting
to,
this.
We didn't even have to try to do that.
But just for the sake of, you know,
so
content.
There were there were some interesting reviews. One of my favorite reviews was Helen for the American Conservative.
Helen Andrew. Helen Andrew. I get confused between Helen Andrew and Helen Lewis and Helen. Aren't there like three Helens?
Keller, of course.
Of course. Well, that's another story for another time.
Yeah. So Helen Andrews pointed out, because there was a scene, I didn't really get it. There was news about, there's a scene in the movie, Barbie lives in Barbie land. She has to travel to the real world because she starts getting cellulite. And it's because of something that has happened with her, the child or the person that's playing with her doll in the real world. Some kind of breakdown there is causing problems in Barbie land, which causes Barbie, the main Barbie played by Margot Robbie, to get cellulite. And so that's obviously, you got to fix that immediately. So she travels to the real world and she's at a bus stop, in Los Angeles, and she sees an old woman and she's like, "You're so beautiful." And the old woman's like, "I know it." And then there were news. So I saw that scene. I didn't really understand it, but I was like, "Oh, okay." Well, then there were news reports that Greta Gerwig, the director, insisted on that scene. It was like, this movie isn't the movie that I'm making if it doesn't have that scene. And I actually just didn't get it. I was like, okay, that's fine. Whatever. Helen points out that like in Barbie land, nobody ages. So there's no old people. And this would have, you know, in the story, Barbie would have never seen an old person until that moment. And then seeing the beauty of that, it's like everything good in life gives you wrinkles. You know, you get old as you have experiences and you live. And that's like the beauty of it. I hadn't piece that together. Maybe other people had, and I'm just dumb, but I didn't really get that until I read Helen's review. And so that it's an interesting message in Barbie, because you start out in Barbie is this, it's a matriarchy. The Barbies kind of run everything, and every night is girls' night, and they're always partying and stuff. And then the Kens, they're only there as sort of accessories, kind of like with the toy. And they joke about, you know, where does Ken live? I don't know. Or what does Ken do when he's not with Barbie? I don't know. You know, kind of the whole storyline is just the Barbies. And then after going to the real world, Ken sees, he learns about the patriarchy, and he brings it back to Barbie land, which quickly, you know, collapses into this sort of exaggerated form of patriarchy where, you know, the women are just carrying around trays of beer and waiting on the men and all this stuff. And so Barbie land is this sort of naive matriarchy that is like defenseless against outside ideas, that immediately kind of crumbles with one of the Kens, the one played by Ryan Gosling, learning about patriarchy. It's also funny because to explain how that happened so quickly, they're like, how did this happen? And they're like, it was like with the indigenous and smallpox, they had no immunity. And I was like, you really don't get a lot of smallpox jokes.
No, you don't.
In films lately. So I was glad to see that brought back.
Good old Barbie bringing it back.
Yeah. And then the resolution, I mean, I hate spoiling it, but everyone's had a lot of time to see it. I mean, the point we're even talking about it, we're kind of late to the game. But basically, the way that they solve the patriarchy thing, I mean, they do rig an election, which would never happen. It's fiction.
It would never happen. Complete fiction.
Of course. No. Never. But they, and then what they land on, they don't go back to the matriarchy that they had before. They basically agree to a society where men and women get along and respect each other. And that point was highlighted in Compact by Nina Power about how the Greta Gerwig is sort of, what Nina says is that Greta Gerwig is sort of putting forth like a fourth wave feminism that primarily involves men and women getting along. Like, and being men and women, because Barbie is, you know, the women are women, the men are men. It's not like there, it's not this sort of androgynous, you know, everybody's kind of one thing, but like the girls are girls, the boys are boys, but they get along and respect each other. And she's kind of, her argument is that that's basically what Greta is for. And that Greta and her partner, I forget his last, Noah, his last name isn't coming to me. I'm not going to effort that, but,
Baumbach.
Okay. I was like, it's like Brambick or something. Okay. That's basically their view on the relationship between the sexes, is that they should get along. And so that's what comes through in the movie. So I thought it was cool from that angle. I didn't think that there was a central wokeness to it. There were definitely some kind of textbook, like, you know, Instagram feminist scenes in the middle.
Yeah.
But like, I actually thought it was an interesting, and then at the end, then, you know, serious spoiler, so skip ahead like a minute or something if you're not wanting to know. But at the end, Barbie decides to go to the real world and become a person rather than staying in Barbie land, which is sort of, Barbie land's already, you know, put back together at this point. And it's after she sees a montage of clips of mothers and daughters and
the Holocaust. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. But it's,
they like open her eyes and they make her sit in that chair and see,
oh yeah, they just
all
catch
the
her
worst
up.
Things to happen to humanity
basically. But no, I mean, she basically decides she wants to go to the real world to be a mom. And so, I mean, that isn't what I would describe as some sort of woke message. The movie basically says it's okay to, you know, I don't mean that, but like, it's okay to just be a mom. You don't have to be a lot of other things like that. That's a worthy thing to be. And so that's why I think that a lot of the people that were talking about how woke it was, that was what they were going to say no matter what was in it. So I thought it was fun. That was the other thing. It was fun.
Did you see that Bill Maher tweet about zombie lies? Did you see that?
I didn't. What was it?
He basically coined, I think he just came up with this whole thing just because he thought the term zombie lies was cool. But he
realize zombie lies.
Exactly. So he said, okay, Barbie, I was hoping it wouldn't be preachy, man-hating, and a zombie lie. Alas, it was all three. What is a zombie lie? Something that never was true, but certain people refuse to stop saying it, or something that used to be true, but no longer is, but certain people pretend is true. Barbie is this kind of zombie lie. He talks about how Barbie fights the patriarchy up to the Mattel board who created her, and in the movie it consists of 12 white men, but in real life it's 7 men and 5 women.
Mm-hmm.
So he basically says, like, that's a zombie lie. And I'm just like, all right, bro, like, no one cares about the Mattel board. It's a movie. Like, that's, to me, it just seems like not a thing.
Yeah. I mean, that's not a central aspect of it, but it is probably, like, I guess if a zombie lie is, I would say that that's true about the patriarchy thing as people imagine it. And it obviously is interesting that they're like you said, though, in the movie. So this stuff didn't to me seem core to the message because they didn't spend a lot of time on it or really. Mm-hmm. It was just sort of there to notice if you wanted. But like, right, there are women on the Mattel board. So, you know, you have to make up an all male board that doesn't exist to explain, to make the point. I mean, it is kind of a zombie lie, and I guess I don't want to adopt that term necessarily, but there are things like that that aren't true or aren't true anymore that people can't grasp. Like in today's world, there is no functioning patriarchy. That's doesn't. And I think you see that when people, you know, any new law comes out and people throw on their handmade robes and march around. It's like you understand that. No time did the world look like The Handmaid's Tale. Like this isn't, it's never been like this, right? Even similar to it. This doesn't mirror any existing time period. But that stuff, I mean, well, okay. But that also goes to the core of like,
he did say that Barbie is fun and he enjoyed it.
That's the important thing. What I was saying in one of my tweets about it was that, you know, it's not inherently a left wing or right wing movie. It's just kind of a fun movie, and I basically said it was a movie that you liked if you're fun and beautiful, and you didn't like it if you're ugly and boring. And in the reviews, if you do look at all the reviews, they sort of fall along those lines, especially the boring part, like boring people, because there were people on the left that criticized it for not, you know, for basically being reactionary in certain ways, and you know, not addressing this or that or the other. One of my favorite tweets I saw, this girl said, I don't know if it was a tweet, it may have been a screenshot on Twitter, but she said, my mom never bought me a black Barbie, so I just used marker to color in her face. And so now I feel bad because she's in Barbie land walking around in blackface.
That's good.
It was good. So Barbie was good. I liked Oppenheimer as well. I don't think I'll ever see it again because it was 3 hours long, and that's really pushing it for me. I've seen a lot of movies this year. My favorite movie of 2023 is No Hard Feelings with Jennifer Lawrence. None of the other movies are quite up to that to me, because comedy is great and you never get comedies anymore. And I think that Jennifer Lawrence has like found her final form. You always worry once somebody wins an Academy Award, they're only going to do serious, boring films that are sort of like you have to like get ready to watch. So I'm glad that she's making movies that you just want to turn on and like watch all the way through and enjoy. So good year for movies right up until the strike. I don't know when the theaters will run out of content, but could happen.
Then everyone can just go back and they'll start playing classic movies. Won't they just bring movies back? Or is that illegal?
I need them to, because there's a lot of movies I haven't seen. And then I've been going to movies primarily because I have the AMC A-list pass. Mm-hmm. Have you heard about this?
Yeah.
So it's like, depending on what state you live in, it's anywhere from $20 to $24. And you can see 3 movies a week, every week. And I signed up for it and then I forgot about it for like 2 years. So I saw one movie in 2022 at the theaters. It was The Batman, and that movie cost me $240. So I've done the math, and I need to see 80 films to break even, and then I can cancel AMC, having made my money back. So I've been going to a lot of movies as a result.
How many have you seen?
I think 15. The most recent that I really liked was Ninja Turtles. It was very good.
Yeah.
It was funny. The dialogue was funny. The pacing was good. It was great. And it's actually a Nickelodeon movie. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
Yeah. So, because Disney's been putting out like flop after flop. And So it's great to see that Nickelodeon seems to be getting its heat back and putting out a great, you know, because they're sort of reviving Ninja Turtles or trying to. And I think it was good. It was totally, you know, fine for kids, but then it was funny to where I also thought it was good for adults without the like gross stuff that they just hope kids don't notice, but they do. It was just seemed well done.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. Got to see it. Well, those Ninja Turtles.
You got to get to 80. You got to get to 80 movies soon.
I know. I'm a Meg 2 is on my list to see this week. And I really like shark movies, but I love that they were like shark movie, but let's just make the shark giant. A lot of movies should take animals and make them bigger.
Throw in some Jason Statham.
Oh yeah. I know you'd have to think he's really, if you like, he's having a summer cause he's in that. What else is he in? He's in something else.
Fast and Furious. Fast X?
Maybe. Yeah, he's, you know, it's a good year for him. It's a good year to be. But, yeah, so.
It's always a good year to be him.
So I liked Barbie. I think it was worth a watch. It was fun. Barbie's really controversial, as people know. Like, so it's a doll, but she also gives people, like, body image issues or makes them feel inadequate or whatever. But it's like, a doll can't really do that. And then Barbie's supposed to be accountable to what this is like the only toy that it's accountable to what it would look like if you blew it up, you know, 500 times the size. And like, oh, if you made it 6 feet tall, you know, it would be, this is how long her neck would be, or this is, and it's like, well, okay. Like, are most toys proportional? Is that one of the rules for toys? Like,
yeah.
Would a Hot Wheel be safe for the road if you blew it up to size? Like what? I mean, it's like nobody's ever really stopped to ask, is that a reasonable criteria to judge a toy? Is what would happen if you made it giant and didn't change anything else? So
that's what should be a podcast. We go through all the toys and just talk about if they were scaled up.
Yeah. And what neuroses that you can blame on the fact that this toy isn't scalable.
Yeah. Yep. So. Well, That's good for the light, fun stuff. Should we actually talk about the dark, depressing stuff now?
Sure. I mean, to the extent that it is, right? So eugenics, you're hearing about it everywhere these days. Everywhere you look, it's eugenics, yeah. Eugenics,
people,
eugenics.
People can't stop talking about eugenics.
And if you've not heard of it, you would hear the word, and it sounds like something that you're friend from high school is trying to sell to you, but also get you to sell, and it makes your like eyelashes longer and you sleep better or something.
And you have like eugenics parties where you all go to a house and they preach to you the how good eugenics is, and you can buy your little eugenics package and sell that to other people.
Exactly.
You know, classic. Yeah.
And so how would you define
eugenics catalog?
Oh, of course. How would you define the recall of recent eugenics products, or the scandal when it's revealed that the products are packaged by children in China?
Yeah.
But how would you define eugenics, Matt?
Bobby did so many eugenics that she wins this year's trip to Tahiti.
There you go.
Well, if I personally, just off the top of my head, I would say it's the study of how to arrange reproduction within a human population to increase the occurrence of heritable characteristics regarded as desirable.
Yeah, that's just right out of the top of your head.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah, so
it would see one group of people thinks one group of thinks a certain group of things are the most desirable. So the goal is to replicate how to make those desirable traits show up in people, or to protect those desirable traits as well.
Right. It's this idea that basically choices and mating and reproduction, and that you need to eliminate, that you can improve the human race and outcomes by who gets to live and reproduce, basically, you know, gene perfecting. And then you have positive and negative eugenics. So positive eugenics is just basically encouraging people that are deemed good to reproduce with each other and make gooder children. And then negative eugenics are things like banning reproduction, or sterilizing people, abortions, you know, genocide. That's kind of your, you sort of have the two.
Just getting rid of people en masse.
Yeah. So that's where you have kind of the two sides of it. I do think most critics of eugenics would say that positive eugenics always leads to negative eugenics, because what do you, if you're encouraging the most, you know, quote unquote fit to reproduce with each other,
yeah,
and that starts happening, right, down the line, what do you do with everybody that wasn't that, you know, like what is the next step? And so, I mean, and I don't, you know, what is that? I don't know. But eugenics is back in the news because, sort of online influencer Richard Hanania, has had a moment in the sun. He's been canceled. He also has a book coming out, I think. It's still coming out. Sometimes after those things, the book's dropped. I think his is still coming out. But he's talked about eugenics. And then there was an article by Michael Lind in Compact, against the eugenicons, critiquing Hanania and those ideas. And so it's, you know, it's what everyone's talking about. You're hearing about it everywhere, eugenics.
Yeah, so we read the article against the eugenicons to talk about it. My first note is the first paragraph. I read it and I'm just like, I'm too dumb for this. It's a whole piece about how people want to get rid of me for being too dumb.
I looked over Matt's notes, and actually that's his note on each paragraph, is I'm too dumb for this.
You really got to be the Anna to my Dasha on this. Am I right, folks?
I don't know. I think Dasha's the smart one, right? Smarter.
Well, that's what I mean. Okay. That's what I mean. That's why I said that, because I'm the smarter one.
Oh, okay. That's right. That's right. So true.
Michael Lind starts this piece off about talking about Donald Trump. And I'm like,
you hear about that
really
guy?
Just can't get away. We just really can't get away from this dude, can we?
He keeps getting indicted.
I
forget what indicted, yeah, Trump, is not, that's where you're going to court.
Yeah, I think they have like substantial stuff, or they have enough. The grand jury says you have enough to go to like trial or something. I don't know.
Uh-oh.
If only we knew a lawyer. Yeah. He starts this off talking about Trump, but Trump doesn't, it's not at all a piece about Trump. And I don't think Trump comes up again.
No.
I just don't know if he just used that as a way to get like people to look into it. But he also talks about Trump in May 2016. Trump said 5-10 years from now, different party. You're going to have a workers' party.
Right.
And
that's the realignment that people talk about, that and this is probably a zombie lie, actually, if that's a thing, but that the Republican Party is going to switch from being the sort of elite productive class or whatever, and it's going to be this multiracial working class. The catch is, was it ever, or even recently? I mean, I think during George Bush, a lot of working class Southerners were for that, you know, were Republican. I mean, Toby Keith, that kind of thing. Like, I don't really know that it's some huge shift, and that you used to have workers, especially white working class people, that they've only just since Trump kind of started switching sides. So it's a little too clean of a thing, but right. This idea that the stances that the Republican Party would take, and what would happen now, is it would shed sort of the neoconservatives, and it would just be this multiracial working class against the sort of global elite that is represented in the Democrat Party.
So his thing, he then says it'll be impossible for the Republican Party to win over more working class white and non-white voters by adopting pro-worker policies as long as a substantial share of GOP donors, journalists, think tankers, and activists structure their politics around hereditarian theories that claim that the patterns of class and race in America and the world are a result of unalterable DNA. Call them eugenic conservatives or eugenicons.
So go ahead.
Like, how many people are talking about? Like, what is it?
Is this saying that you're?
Is this real life or is this just like a person on Twitter?
I mean, I don't know. It bleeds in because he's basically just saying that you're not going to have a multiracial working class party if a huge group of that party are basically just racist. Like, if he's saying that, like, if there's a group of the party that says, you know, black people and Hispanics are genetically inferior, then you're not going to have black people and Hispanics want to be part of a coalition with them and make this multi-class or, multi-racial working class party. I mean, and that's maybe true, but kind of isn't. I mean, because there's a weird, I don't think that a lot of it is an online thing because people day to day don't see them engaging in this like overtly racist like talking points and talking about is this race genetically dumber or whatever. But I mean, yeah, I don't know, but that's the idea that it's starting with. It's just saying that you can't actually expand the GOP, the Republican Party, to include working class people if you're also subdividing them into races and pitting them against each other along those lines. And so it's not a way to win elections. And he does sort of expand on that as he goes, because he talks about, okay, consider that basically college-educated voters and college-educated white voters are becoming more and more aligned with the Democratic Party, as well as just the wealthiest Americans, the 1% people are much more likely to be Democrats. So how do you win? How do you become the dominant party? How is it a winning strategy to, take a stance that says that certain races are inferior, but you like your own race, isn't really interested. So you're running off other working class people who aren't white, but you're also not even appealing to the most successful, by standard definitions, white people. If you're not getting rich whites and educated whites, but you're also being racist, so you're not going to get any blacks or Hispanics. What do you do there? That's, I think, the argument. And, it kind of makes sense that there's some contradictions there if you think it's a winning strategy to, do that.
Well, that makes more. See, this is why I need you to talk me through these, because when I say I'm too dumb, you just put it in a, you put it in a way that my dumb brain understood.
Well, what's weird is
he says, "No, you go." I was going to move on to something, but go on.
Well, some of this ties back to anti-racism, especially the kind of exaggerated, speaking circuit anti-racism that became big during the pandemic. People that was not appealing to a lot of people of a lot of races and classes and whatnot, because it proposes this never-ending kind of hatred between races. And it also makes it to where people that are workers that don't have any agency or like say in things are having to apologize to other workers for historical oppression. I mean, it's not a working model, and people want to rebel against that. But what they've done is they've flipped it on their heads and they've just kind of embraced those ideas, but in reverse, by like, oh yeah, the races are forever and permanently, antagonistic against each other. And they,
sure. I mean, that seems like a place that it would kind of land. Like, I don't know why anyone would be surprised by that. Like,
yeah.
If even like, who's the white fragility, Robin DiAngelo, like she's going around giving speaking, she's doing like speaking gigs where she's just, she's a white lady who's telling white people how like terrible they are. And like, at some point you're just like, all right, if I'm just constantly apologizing for all these things and doing all this stuff, like, why wouldn't I just,
yeah, know, there's
not saying the majority would, but they, but even like just a few would just be like, why? Like,
yes,
I'm sorry I picked up this paper from the printer the wrong way.
Right. There's some portion of people that if you just keep telling them you're racist and no matter what you do, you're going to be racist, they're going to be like, oh, based. All right. Like, I'm racist. So that's not a majority. And I don't really think the backlash to anti-racism is as strong as anybody online wants you to think. But yeah. And in a sense, this is sort of saying, look, you have to look past owning the libs. Like, you can't just always be pushing, you can't always just be trying to make people mad by saying things that go against the sort of white fragility corporate HR push in the 2020, like in 2020. Mm-hmm. you have to actually engage with reality and with ideas and sort of look at things as they are. It can't always be owning the libs. It can't always be backlash. And you kind of see it bloom into the broader sort of free speech absolutist thing where people, they just want to say things that are, you know, make people outraged and get those clicks and those likes. And so talking about race, we'll do that. Obviously certain things, cause I mean, your typical American is, you know, really kind of believes in everybody being equal. Like, there was this big push against this starting around 2014 of just the whole, I don't see color, or, you know, I think everybody's the same, mm-hmm. but that's pretty much the standard mindset around Americans. They don't really think that somebody's race determines everything about them. And the push to change that has definitely come in multiple forms, sometimes in some versions of the anti-racist stuff. And then obviously with the race, you know, the more like race realists and that kind of stuff of trying to take everything back to race in a very reductionist form. I just think the boat has sailed. You're just not going to convince most Americans that race is everything for long. Like, they could fall. I mean, I think 2020, everyone's cooped up. It's COVID. You haven't gone anywhere. All you have is TV and online videos. And the only way to leave your house is to go to, you know, protest or whatever. Like, yeah, everyone kind of took in a lot of stuff that they've probably moved on from since then. But you're not really going to convince people that everybody's all that different, or that the race that you are defines everything about you, whether that's good or bad, whether you frame it as something good or bad. I don't think you're going to convince most people. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what Lind is saying, is that this isn't a winning strategy. It's not going to work. It's not working. And he points out that it's intellectually, like, it's not serious. And there's a lot of kind of circular references between a handful of different scholars that have sort of been debunked at different times. But the cover that these people get is this whole, oh, well, you can't talk about this without getting canceled, so it must be true. Or, you know, this is really taboo in our,
right,
in our hyper woke world, and therefore it's true.
Yeah.
And that's not like reasonable. That's not a way to actually have politics or a way to form ideas, is what are you not allowed to talk about, or what are you not allowed to say or think? And then just that must be true. Cause I mean, that never ends. I mean, these people, you get really far down that line of what are you not allowed to talk about? And okay, that must be true.
Well, it would be the same excuse on the other end for like drag culture, or like trans culture, right? Like, they're a long time you weren't able to talk about it. So like, by default, that must be true right now, but now you can talk about it. So then the other stuff must be true. It just be just kind of like a replacement. Whatever is too taboo becomes not taboo. And then the not taboo becomes taboo. So it's just like, whatever's not in power is the thing that you can't talk about. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Just kind of constantly, just being constant, the never ending, you know, critical aspect of things, and just, okay, well, if it's being suppressed, then it's good. And if it's being, you know, promoted, then it's bad. Yeah. I mean, that doesn't get you anywhere true necessarily. It can only really be true accidentally. the world isn't organized and structured enough for there to be actually some sort of mechanism that only true ideas are suppressed and only false ideas are promoted. Like, that would require a lot of cooperation and intelligence that isn't there. So you can't, like,
and you would just have to, like, keep a list. Like, it's just it'd be tiring to keep a list, Zach.
Yeah, it'd be a long list. It'd be a long list. So the eugenics thing, it's this on the lib culture. Like, I don't know if you saw on Twitter, there was this video of this woman that serves coffee to, like, homeless people or whatever. And she was, I mean, you can see in the video, she was a large person. She had kind of a short haircut that wasn't the most flattering. Like, you know, you could kind of sense that if you saw what she looked like. And a poster just is like, how do you explain people that look like this? Like, basically just saying how she was ugly and this is, like, the fault of Nickelodeon or something. And everyone's reaction to that was negative. They're like, this person looks happy and is literally making coffee for people and is fine. Like, how can you be criticizing this woman? And then a few journalists found out who she was, and she literally is, like, a feed the homeless, like, Christian type. You know, she's like what most people would agree is textbook of a good person. And I would say if you watch the video, you can see a lot of inner beauty there. And if you can't see that, then that's something about your humanity that's, like, missing. And if all you can see is this person's fat,
that's what we learn from Barbie. So
yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah.
No, you said Barbie saw the inner beauty of the older lady.
Oh yeah. So. Okay. That's a good point. Yeah. I hadn't connected that.
I'm trying to tie it in.
But yeah, I mean, a lot of these kind of online, it's this idea that calling strangers ugly because it's taboo must be like, oh, that's free speech. And what I'm doing is good and it's important work and it's transgressive. And it's like, well, no, it's just repulsive to humans. And again, if you can't watch, I mean, the video of the coffee, the lady, have you seen it? Oh, okay.
Well, no.
You can see pretty quickly that she's a lovely person. And if you can't see that, which it seems like a lot of these people couldn't who were criticizing her, there's just something missing. Like, you just don't, you're not.
Yeah. But I mean, that's on them. Like, they're, what are you missing? What? Like, like, you're saying the people that are criticizing are missing, like,
just the piece of their humanity something that allows them to actually assess somebody's entire, like, what that person offers, like, the level of, because the whole calling people ugly thing, it's been going on for a few years. It was maybe funny at first, but calling just, like, random strangers fat or ugly or, you know, looking at their age mm-hmm. and extrapolating that on what their fertility is or whatever, like, yes, it outrages people, but again, that doesn't make it a good thing to do. You're not doing something transgressive, you're not advancing any cause,
yeah.
But you're just kind of revealing yourself to just be missing, like, core aspects of like being human. And I'm not actually thinking of any specific people when I say this, but a lot of the eugenics and the people pushing this are like, oh, you shouldn't reproduce if, you know, you have any kind of defects, or if you're this, or those people shouldn't be allowed to reproduce because they're stupid or whatever. Like,
yeah,
a lot of them have, like, flaws that they can't come to terms with, like, either in their appearance mm-hmm. or their health or their mind or whatever. And as a result, they want to, like, blame it on their ancestors for being irresponsible in their breeding. And they want to, like, take this from everybody, and they want to, like, promote this eugenics thing. And it's like their own unresolved issues is, like, the psychology of why you would be a eugenicist, and you would want, you know, again, to ban certain people from reproducing, and you would want to, like, you'd be constantly thinking about the gene pool and making it better, making it worse. And, like,
yeah, but what's the goal? I mean, is the goal to, like, just stir it up on Twitter, or is the goal, like, really, do they think that they, by doing that, there can be some,
it's both. Like, I think there's a certain aspect of, under the guise of wanting a perfect society, or maybe thinking that's what they want. It is, I still think, seeing flaws yeah. and wanting to just blame their ancestors for not being more responsible in breeding choices, and they just want to remove those things, like the unhappiness. But then because it gets blowback on Twitter and it owns the libs, they just kind of, that confirms them in it, and they want to dig deeper. And then you start getting into stats and you start kind of taking it further. That it's like this snowball effect that happens there.
So basically, he, in this piece, Michael Lind just talks about, like, he, you know, they're trying to blend eugenics with socialism or progressivism, or like some in the Northeast, like the American the Anglo-American Protestants, like try to, you know, they're more conservative. And I like that he said it was they who provided the endowments, the leadership, and the volunteer advocacy to stave off what they saw as the displacement or pollution of the Anglo-Saxon, Nordic, Aryan American race by Jews, Irish, Italians, Blacks, Mexicans, and other assorted, allegedly inferior groups. What I really liked about that is this group from the Northeast was just like, we give all the money and we're in all the positions of power, so that must mean that we're the best. And if any of these Italians come in, they're going to ruin it for us. And like, to me, it's the difference between, he talks about this, like the actual exceptional qualities of people, or just like the accidents of birth. Like they, maybe like, are they really better because they, because some people think they, he touches on like how some people think that the elites, like the ones who have the money or ones that made all these choices or have come from these families, are the smarter ones. But really it's just like,
well, not just smarter, but like genetically destined to be smarter. Like they're smarter because because their bloodlines are smarter, because their race is smart, not just they're smart, so they win. And that, I mean, in the idea that the people at the top are genetically superior is tricky. I mean, you look at Bill Gates and like, those are not good genes, people. Like good genes don't combine like that. There's aspects to it, right? The nature versus nurture. He talks about certain diaspora groups that have like been fled their homeland or have moved, and they are really successful where they go, you know, at attaining education and you know, economics, getting good jobs, starting things. But they also outshine the average person from their race, from their homeland. And you start to see that, you know, to some degree, it's this, you know, the way that you select and group people can matter. And it doesn't seem to be some sort of inborn trait that predicts whether you're going to be successful, or something that you can, again, engineer through deciding who gets to mate with who and guarantee outcomes of being, you know, smarter or dumber. And part of the conflict is between, and you see more of this in the right, but basically between Christian notions of dignity and, you know, the soul and things like that. And then more pagan or pre-Christian kind of notions of, you know, trying to evolve to be better, you know, survival of the fittest, you know, cutting out the weak, things like that. Yeah. And it's this whole, you know, going back to like 2016, you know, Christianity is cucked type thing, that because Christianity means that nobody can get abortions, and therefore poor people are going to have more kids because they get the most abortions, and you're going to have more people from these groups. And that obviously that Christianity, if you follow it, then you're going to end up with all these undesirable people having kids that they can't abort, and their kids are going to have kids, and people are just going to keep getting dumber and worse as time goes on.
We're just going to become a dumb society of dishwashers.
Yeah, basically. I mean, that's what we're, and then the weird thing is it doesn't hold over time, as he points out in the article. Obviously, not so much the Irish, that's sort of overhyped, but the Italians were not at any point, they were not deemed as being white, and there were concerns about what the Italians would do to the gene pool. Everybody's going to be a plumber or something. Yeah.
Mamma mia. Like,
And now, obviously, Italians are part of that. Like, nobody really sees them as non-white. And again, their arrival in America goes back two centuries, a century and a half. So that's not enough time for genes to reshape. And there's just this sort of over it's overclassified. Like these really aren't set stable categories. And I mean, just being Italian, like that didn't really exist. Italian Americans happened before town because you had all these different nations. And so to try to suppose yeah. that these fixed categories predate any sort of government structure or state apparatus, and that therefore the state sort of flows from representing these groups that exist sort of out of nature, it's quite a stretch, because it just doesn't really work. Like what are those groups, and can you list those groups and look at a 100-year period where those groups are like intact? It doesn't mean that there's no such thing as race, but it's not nearly as cookie cutter as I think the eugenicists suppose, which would mean you can't sit and make little tweaks to the model to make everybody tall and beautiful and intelligent, because you don't have controlled inputs. You don't have really definite categories and stable variables here.
Yeah, I mean, try as we like, the Italians are going to be let into this country whether or not we want them to, right?
So true. So true.
Yeah.
And so
Italian is the only, like, I don't have a lot of pride in my history or like my whatever culture, because I'm basically just a mutt, but Italian is the thing I think I'm the most of. I don't know.
That's, is that just it, from being,
I don't
just
really
being lazy,
have any.
Or did you get a test? 23
yeah, it's
me.
From like,
I mean, 23andMe has a eugenics component.
Yeah, guy eats a pizza once and thinks he's Italian.
23andMe has kind of a eugenics component, if you take it that way, because it tells you all these things that you're sort of predisposed for. And I definitely know people in real life that were thinking about that in terms of should they have kids or not. And it's like, a gluten intolerance yeah. is not a reason to not have a kid. Like, what is going on?
Well, that's the main thing of like, you really get into, I don't know if you want to go straight to this or not or what, but like, it's just really all I thought is you already brought up like the Christian idea of like the soul, and, but it really highlights the difference between just like the belief in God and the belief in just pure like evolution, right? Like it, to me, if we're all evolved from whatever, and we just came from like, you know, lizards or little amoebas or whatever the Museum of Natural History tells us we yeah. came from, why isn't this a proper conversation? This seems like perfectly in line with how life should
yeah,
go.
Yeah, I mean, it
right?
is a direct...
But we know...
Well, I was saying, what? I mean, it is like an obvious conclusion to draw from evolution, because you're saying, right, that through time, through natural selection, you know, the better thing, I mean,
yeah.
it was called social Darwinism up until World War II.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, if you have a belief in God and the soul, and you believe that, you know, you have the sort of form of what a person is.
And that
does, you know, replicate through time, through generations, through reproduction, but that ultimately everything that the form has is what it can pass on. It can't pass on anything it didn't have. And so it's more or less fixed in the grand scheme of things. Then you don't, mm-hmm. you're not tempted to think that it's irresponsible for people to have kids if they have food allergies. Because now more people have food allergies.
Right, because they, yeah, when we're, because we're, when we're made in the image and likeness of God, that's the higher faculties, right? Like the intellect and the will. It's not that like God looks like us in our physical form, right? With all our whatever, blah, 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 this is what God looks like. So yeah, so that's where you realize, like, that's when the other stuff just becomes the other things, right? It's not, it's a matter of, we protect humanity because have the higher faculties of the intellect and the will, and the intellect may look different or the will may be not perfectly aligned, but at the same time, it's
right.
It is what it is. So if the other stuff, if it's just a pure discussion about trying to figure out how to evolve the perfect human, then like, of course these conversations should be, if it's just science, then science is not a moral thing. Science is just a ridiculous thing that like just is brutal and looks to find whatever the perfect thing is, regardless of how it treats other things. So you just, it seems to me that if, and people who, atheists will still claim to have some moral thing, you have some moral belief, even though they don't believe in God. And that's just like, I mean, that's just them not connecting the wires correctly. Like it's, it, you know, they want to have it all without having that actual belief in the higher being, I guess, which is a tangent for another time. But it really struck me as it's ridiculous to try and like mutate all these things within a 20-year period. But of course, that's what you're going to want to do if your end game is just pure science, pure having everything on this floating rock be the best.
Right. I mean, if you think that basically monkeys that were the most successful transformed into humans through generations of reproduction, then you also think that can go the other direction through bad choices of reproduction. And therefore, now that we know these things and we have the ability to control them, and we have abortion and we have birth control, we need to make sure that we keep that line going up from monkeys to humans to superhumans. And I don't really know how you can.
Yeah.
I mean, I think to me, they're sort of connected. There's also some funny points to the Lind article.
But at the same time, that took forever. I was going to say that took forever. So the idea that it can just be like replicated over a decade is insane too. It just the idea of evolution just took millions and trillions of years. So like the idea that we can just kind of that's when you see the eugenics is like when in Iceland, when they say how they've eradicated Down syndrome, they haven't cured or solved Down syndrome. They've just killed every person that has Down syndrome, right? They don't even let them live. So at the end of the day, you're not actually solving anything. You're just getting rid of the people with the undesirable traits. What were you going to say before I said that?
It's just this fear of people evolving back into apes if you don't do something, if you don't intervene and prevent that from happening. And then sort of this idea that modern technology and modern comforts have reduced things like infant mortality, and they've made it to where people can live through multiple births more so than before. And that therefore there's no longer this natural mechanism ensuring only the fittest survive. So we've got to enforce it. The Lind piece, though, I was going to say, has some kind of funny quirks about it. Like he points out that I don't like dog piles. And I really didn't think the Lind piece spent a lot of time on Richard Hanania trying to like further dog pile on him after he was doxxed or whatever for some of his stuff. But he points out, and make sure to point out, I think twice, that Richard Hanania is Arab American and basically not white. And I kind of laughed because I was like, oh yeah, I got to throw that in.
Yeah.
And then he talks about some of the scholars that get cited by eugenicists. And one of them is this, J. Philippe Rushton, who has this theory on brain to penis ratio. You saw that? So it's this idea that among races, that there's an inverse correlation between how large the brain is and how large the penis is. And then the next thing that I think is also questioned by some scholars is whether a larger brain means more intelligent and successful, but saying, you know, the races that are the smarter, it's because they have the largest brain. And you can actually relate the largest brains correspond to the smallest genitals. And then the opposite is true in the other direction. Extends that to common stereotypes about races and those types of things. So that was pretty funny.
Was he just telling on himself?
He's trying to explain why he's so smart and why that's okay. The Rushton. So it's interesting. It's definitely worth reading. The conclusions, I think one of the best parts of the Lind article is when he summarizes the core conclusions and components of a eugenic mentality. He says the human races are few, identifiable, discrete, and enduring through time. again, he's criticizing this. He's saying this isn't true, but one of the axioms is that the other one, you know, the existing hierarchy of education and wealth within a race corresponds to the genetic fitness of individuals and families in that race. So basically, again, if you're rich, it's your genes that made you that way. And if you're not, it's your genes. Just as some individuals are genetically superior to others within a race, so some races are genetically superior to others. And then most economic growth and scientific and cultural progress in history are the result of genetic endowments of superior individuals, families, and races. So again, it's this idea that you've got clean categories that you can work with, you know, stable over time, measurable inputs, that those, you know, the people doing well, it's because of what category they're in, what genes they have. And that this is clear because even when you know people within a race that are smarter or dumber, that races themselves relate to each other like that. And then that basically if you know, the good stuff happens because the superior people are able, when they're in control, good things happen. And so then that leads to certain policies that you know, you shouldn't be taxing or otherwise slowing down the elite to help everyone else, because that actually hurts everybody. That, you know, anti-poverty, trying to work with people to get them out of poverty, things like that are always going to fail because these people, their genes are there. You can't change what they're born with. Mm-hmm. And that you need to use public policy to actually stop people from reproducing if they shouldn't be reproducing according to these categories. That, you know, immigration needs to play into that too, as far as who's allowed to come to your country, and that giving everybody an equal voice in a democracy is dangerous because some people need to be heard more than others for genetic mm-hmm. reasons.
But if all the dumb people get thrown into the river, who will do the work for the rich? Yeah, like
it's just like I can never think when I'm trying to podcast. Kelly Osbourne said, you know, if you kick every Latino out of this country, who is going to clean your toilet, Donald Trump?
Exactly. Who's going to clean the toilets? Well, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the catch is it takes observations that are noticeable. Like some people are smarter than others, and societies have definitely had times where they've listened to smarter, gifted people and that's been good. And they've listened to dumb people and that's been bad. But then it adds this sort mm-hmm. of scientific aspect of this, where this is something that can be modeled and tracked on to racial categories that are constant. Like that's really where you, in any kind of system of belief like this, is going to be a mixture of things. It's going to be things that are common sense that you can see, combined with things that, you know, that sound too smart to really delve into. So you just kind of have to defer to the experts on it. And so the Lind piece does a good job, I think, distilling this and breaking it down. If every point he made isn't a point I would have made, you know, so be it. But I do think that it does a good job attacking this as some sort of organizing principle for a political movement that expects to be successful. And he points out again, if what you're suggesting, and, you know, even if you're saying you're not partial, it's just what the data says. But if what you're getting at is that white people are superior, you're a movement that doesn't attract whites at the top of the ladder. Mm. The educated, wealthy whites aren't interested in this stuff. And so what is your...
A white guy and a doing research. It's like, I'm sorry, I just can't help it if I'm superior. Yeah. That's what the data shows. This is the data. He just holds up his phone.
It's just, and he points out the losing factor is that you're not actually attracting the people that are, you're not winning with elite whites. So what is your path to victory? Who's your constituency for these ideas? What is it? Where's it going to get you? Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Lynn says, instead, a certain kind of conservative seems to find reductive explanation of group disparities based on race more palatable than complex ones that include culture and class, which I mean, sure, he's right in that, but I also think it extends to like everybody, because they just don't want, like, the whole goal for elites basically is just to distract us from having a conversation about class, right? Like they need to like make sure that everybody is pitted against each other, but no one is pitted against them, because they realize that like the working class is being held down by
other people.
Yeah, I
mean, you're out
so
mad about black people, but starter homes are $1 million and you're never going to afford one. Like, there's just certain things that it's a lot easier to just do culture war stuff. And you can turn that dial up a lot higher by adding the race thing. And in all of it, you're not actually getting it at what's actually causing history to turn. Like, what's really going on? And I think that's important.
Yeah. So he's right. I mean, he's right that like some people feel when you feel like you're not in control, you just kind of latch on to whatever you can latch on to explain something. So he's right in saying that there are conservatives who, you know, blah, blah, blah. This is happening because of this, but really it's really just a war being waged on both sides. Yeah. You can't even get the truck. I don't know a lot about what happened with the trucker convoy in Canada, but it can't be about class or it can't be about something there. It has to be about.
Yeah. They found like one person with a Confederate flag. So it could quickly be like, no, this is a white supremacist thing. It's not truckers advocating for their well-being. Yeah. I mean, it's really easy. And again, that was what I always said was the problem with the white fragility thing is that you've literally got workers in the same class as each other who are more or less subject to the same forms of oppression and suppression. You know, I mean, I get that there's marginal differences, but they're apologizing to each other for things that are ultimately controlled by people at the top. And that's not how it works. You know, it's a distraction from the material realities, from what's actually happening, people's ability to live life and provide for themselves and thrive. It's all distracted by who's privileged and who's, you know, genetically inferior and who's basically who was born the bad guy.
Right. For libertarians at a loss to explain why wealth and power are concentrated in market societies, eugenicons have an answer. Rich people and rich families are genetically superior. I sent this to you and I said, do people actually argue this? Like,
well,
do, like
kind of,
I, on so, what level, like on what level, cause I know that, wait, sorry, one sec. I know that people like, they always feed to us that like, if you work hard enough, you can be a CEO and make millions of dollars a year and you can be the best you possibly can. But that's like, obviously not true. And most people know that I just don't know. Libertarians have a lot of weird libertarian thoughts, but the idea that I just don't know how often I've seen people argue that rich people and rich families.
So not the genetic part, because I don't think that's how most people think, but I do think that your typical American would see a billionaire and say that person has done it better. They've made the right choice. They didn't get the $4 latte. Yeah. Or the avocado toast, you know, they kind of see people deserve, they see people as deserving of what they have, like starting from what people have, they extrapolate that they are deserving of that. And they kind of give those people power because, you know, people were always, I mean, because it got really big a few years ago when people were just in awe of like Mark Cuban for selling internet radio to Yahoo. And people were in awe of Bill Gates, Elon Musk,
like can do whatever he wants.
That, you know, there's a sense that they've earned it or they deserve it. And then explaining how or why. I mean, I do think that that's a common belief. I don't think anybody looks at wealthy people. You're not, most people, unless they're like online or academics, are not going to say that these people made it to the top because they, you know, were born on third base or because they exploited workers. You know, when they see how rich Jeff Bezos is, they don't think, well, that's because he worked that off he earned that off of the backs of Amazon workers. They say, oh, Amazon workers are taking Jeff Bezos' money with their salaries. Like there's this idea that like, so that part is there, but it's still for merit. It's not, I don't think your average person thinks, oh, it's genetics. Cause it just, that hasn't really made it to the norm, but the normies definitely, I would think, have this sort of meritocratic view of wealthy people that they don't view it again as exploiting workers and or like inheriting something and being lucky. They mostly say that like any of us could have been Mark Zuckerberg if we just tried. And that's like left, right, center. Like that's just a normal person take, is that like everybody yeah. has a fair shot and any of us could be a billionaire tomorrow. And maybe, I don't know. I mean, you can try, I'll try, but it's, you know, there's a lot that isn't kind of making it into the normie dialogue.
Mm-hmm. When the one where I kind of rolled my eyes at, and maybe you can tell me why I'm wrong or right. As all this shows, race realist science, in scare quotes, seldom rises above the level of stereotypes. Westerners are disciplined by nature, Africans aren't. Asians by nature are math nerds, blonde women are dumb. In the decades and centuries to come, all sorts of group differences in biology, including perhaps group differences in various kinds of intelligence, may well be identified, but this will be done in laboratories and other controlled settings by actual scientists, by geneticists and biologists and physicians. It won't be done by right-wing shock jocks poring over statistical tables and publishing their research in trade press books and club newsletters written and edited by their fellow true believers. I don't know. It just that, like, I guess I get what he's trying to say, but at the same time, it's just like, all
right. I mean, I think the point is people are pretty well persuaded by like reading a lot of PDFs that someone sent them, and that like, you kind of need to recognize that this isn't, you know, there's more to science than a chart and like one study, but you can see the excess, like nobody actually thinks blondes are dumb. Like that's a joke category. Nobody thinks that for real, even internet people. So you can see kind of some excess in the phrasing, in the paragraph.
Yeah, I just don't know, like, I don't know what would actually be done in laboratories and other controlled settings by actual scientists and genetic, like, if anything, that felt to me like and I know this is not his take, but it reads more like, guys, we'll be able to do proper eugenics, just give it time.
Real racism hasn't been discovered in the lab. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah. We'll soon be able to do that.
On them finding out that, well, there is something that always predicts success or intelligence or whatever that you can find in a gene. You know, maybe he's just hedging to make sure he hasn't totally walled himself off from like any sort of like hard realities about these things.
But again, what if there is the conversation, then that's when the conversation shifts over to like,
well, I mean, and again, the
God, well, God the, versus God,
the argument that a lot of people take, and maybe they're right, but basically that any real recognition of these things necessarily leads to a genocide. And there's definitely evidence to support that. Right. I mean, you have the Holocaust, you have those types of things. So, you know, that's part of the concern, is that any type of thinking like this means genocide. And so, you know, that's something that's always kind of top of mind there.
Hmm. Yeah. He talked about in one of the parts, like they thought that white people who lived in the cold were more like able to deal with all that life threw at them because they lived in the cold. And the part that made me laugh out loud was when Michael Lind said, under such conditions, those humans who were slightly more predisposed to or better at cooperating would likely have had better reproductive success. And he says, hunting woolly mammoths on the tundra required advanced planning, you see, but on the savannah, you could just reach out and grab a gazelle as it ran by. And I liked that. And that was a good point of like, as someone who lives in a place where it is extremely hot in the summer, like I would like to see a bunch of those cold tundra living nonsense people make it down here in the 120 degree heat. That's where my 120 degree heat superiority complex comes in.
Yeah. I mean, Arizona is pretty rough. I could never, would never. Yeah, I mean, again, the idea with that whole cold thing is they're basically saying, okay, you had to be able to cooperate with people and function like this to survive. So the ones that couldn't, the wild men, they died because they froze to death. And therefore, there was this evolutionary change in the population to being more like a certain type of thing. And again, that's just, that's not how things work. But
that's just people doing things. That's not like an actual gene forms where one person is like, what the one person had the gene for like stubbornness and not wanting to work together. And then all of a sudden it popped and you're just like, now we see that the gene for working together come along.
So, you know, in the end, it's an interesting piece. Definitely read it if you hadn't. It's a evolving situation on the ground with Richard and Anya. I don't like dog piles or cancellations. So I haven't really looked into the, I get that he said genuinely terrible things on these, anonymous blogs, but it's never my nature to join
also
on that kind of stuff. Like, it doesn't brighten my day at all.
Also, like, Richard Hanania used a pseudonym and it was Richard Host. So like, he used his first name and he used a last name that started with the same letter that his real
if
last
this
name.
One thing
like
yeah OPSEC
guys
people,
if you're gonna
OPSEC come on
Yeah, use if you're going to go anonymous or you're going to use a pseudonym, you got to go full pseudonym. Like this is a mark against his smartness in my book. He needs to be talking about his own place in this perfect society where we get rid of the dumbs. He might be first on the chopping block.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely bad OPSEC. And so, you know, you gotta be careful on that. If you're going to say terrible things and you don't want your name on them, then probably don't put almost your name on them.
Basically, when that's the other thing, like another point that Lynn makes is there's just, you can get money from people for it. Like, there's just people who are willing to just throw money at whatever. And there's like a huge donor class that will just give you money for this.
Yeah, I mean, that just is a reminder. We probably need to tax some of these people because you can find donors to give you like $100K to do any crazy thing. Like, there's people ready to write that amount of checks for almost any crazy theory you can come up with. So, but until we find the person that wants to fund us, we will have to wrap it up and move on with our lives. But definitely read the article, check into it. Think about eugenics. You know, I mean, it's probably true. You know, hot people generally produce hot offspring, but I'm not going to name names, but there's some noted exceptions in Hollywood. And so two perfectly hot people can have a pretty ugly baby. So it's not science. It's not guaranteed.
One last thing. The eugenics was developed largely by Sir Francis Galton as a method of improving the race. And he posited that he urged superior people to podcast with each other. That was his policy prescription for how he pushed forward, is when two superior people decide to start
a
podcast.
That's why we're here, folks.
So
we're heeding the call.
All right. Well, thanks for listening to this episode. Thanks for all the nice comments on us coming back. It was nice to see. We got a lot of people who were happy that we brought the podcast back, and we didn't know what to expect, but it was nice to see everybody
excited
about it.
Yes, thanks for not forgetting about us.
Thank you for that.
And we will see you next time.
Talk to you later.